Welcome back to another exciting edition of the SB Nation podcast. With me, as always, Dylan Gwynn of Sports Talk 790. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Last Monday, of course, it was the Texans' first preseason game against the Jets here at Reliant Stadium. Your overall impression, 7 sacks, which we've seen the stat that last year they only had 8 in all of the preseason. Shaw was a little inaccurate. The run defense was a little rough. Your overall thoughts?
Overall thoughts is, honestly, you have to be pleased. I mean, you couldn't have expected much from the offense in that game with no Arian Foster, no Andre Johnson. I'm not really that concerned about the offensive side of the ball, but, I mean, you can't be overly disappointed in that. You mentioned a lot of the reasons why you have to be very positive about the defensive side, not just the fact that they were able to get pressure consistently throughout the game, but they were able to get pressure consistently with different people throughout the game. And then Brian Braman, the rookie from West Texas A&M, Brooks Reed, who is their, you know, high second-round pick, who I think they eventually envision as being the starter, outside linebacker guy. I mean, that's, you know, the fact that they got to the quarterback early and often, and also that they didn't give up any big plays in this game with the starters on the field. And remember, Jonathan Joseph didn't play in this game.
Right.
But Santonio Holmes and Derek Mason did. So, I mean, the fact that essentially last year's secondary was able to get through their time on the field without giving up a huge bomb to anybody. And granted, the Jets are not a big play offense, but at the same time, they didn't give up anything to those guys in terms of big plays, and I thought that was huge.
Yeah, that was an encouraging sign. Something that wasn't quite as encouraging, granted it is preseason, so I don't want to overreact too much.
Which means we're about to overreact.
Yes. But Mario Williams, let's face it, he struggled. If he continues to struggle, let's say he looks horrible again in the Saints game, would you consider, and at what point would you consider this, moving him back to defensive end, starting Brooks Reed and Connor Barwin at the two outside linebacker spots? And if you do that, would you either put Antonio Smith back on the bench and maybe even cut him, or experiment with moving J.J. Watt back inside to tackle?
I've marked the end of the San Francisco game as my official time of panic.
Okay.
I think I'm going to give it 3 games. If he hasn't shown me something by the end of the San Francisco game, I think it's time to panic, because you need at least a week with whatever front seven you're going to go into week one with. You need at least a week, 10 days to practice with those guys. As far as what lineup you would shift to, I actually kind of like the idea of Mario and J.J. Watt as the ends and maybe moving Antonio Smith inside.
Okay.
I think Antonio Smith would be a better nose guard than Sean Cody is right now. And I also, you know, I was thinking about this. I also don't like the idea of minimalizing what J.J. Watt is really, really good at. J.J. Watt is really good as a pass rusher. I think that's how he's going to make his mark in the league. He's going to be like a Richard Seymour type guy. The stats may not always be there, but he's going to be drawing double and sometimes even maybe triple teams, you know, to keep
some
him away
from... Some
of the other
coach has the game plan.
Exactly.
For.
Like Richard Seymour had some of the worst stats out of anybody on the Patriots defense, but he was their MVP because he drew all that attention. I see J.J. Watt as kind of being that guy. I would actually consider moving Antonio Smith inside, keeping Watt outside, and Mario on the end position, as opposed to moving J.J. Watt inside. And honestly, I think he could do it. That's not really the issue. I think he could do it. But I think you're taking away what he's best at, which I think, as we saw Monday night, is getting
in
the backfield and messing with the quarterback's head.
I agree, because like you said, with Richard Seymour and the stats not showing up, J.J. Watt, the same thing. He didn't record a sack, but we all saw the sack that Earl Mitchell got that he essentially caused, pushed the guard back in, forced Sanchez to step up, and then Earl Mitchell cleaned it up. Now, you're okay then with waiting to the San Francisco game? My only thought with that was, if you're going to make the change, wouldn't you want to be able to see that change in the San Francisco game when starters will actually play?
I see your point. And yeah, ideally, you would want to. But at the same time, I think you need to give this a little bit of time. And remember, big lockout, no playbooks distributed, no film room time with the coaches, no nothing like that. You know, I think that you have to give it at least another week because of that. Also, Mario, I mean, we know Antonio Smith can play the nose. We know Mario can play the end. And we know J.J. Watt can play the end. So, I mean, what kind of learning curve are you really? I mean, what kind of learning curve are you really going through there? I don't think much of one, because J.J. Watt's the only rookie out of the three guys we just mentioned, and he's staying right where he is.
He's not playing like a rookie. He looks like he's an NFL veteran already.
Right, exactly. I mean, he looks phenomenal, but he would be staying in the same position he is. I think you wait until after week three for panic. And I will officially let you know when it's time to panic.
We need some sort of panic button.
Oh, you'll know it. Just look at my face.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like the coaches are. Everything you read from Kubiak, and granted, he says this all the time. He even said it about Kareem Jackson last year. But he doesn't seem worried. My big overall worry going into this, and hopefully this isn't the case, was, but he was never a very explosive defensive end. He's more of a bull rusher, uses his size and his strength. And in an outside linebacker, that's going to be even more exaggerated. If he doesn't have that quick burst off the edge.
He doesn't have a great first step.
Right.
That's a huge
problem at outside linebacker.
Exactly. He never has. And he's never had to worry about over pursuing.
Right.
Which is, you know, and as they were mentioning this on the Monday night broadcast, I mean, the Jets recognized that right away, that he was over pursuing.
They ran right at him.
And they ran right at him, or right between him, you know, right between him and Watt, and they ran inside of him, and they recognized that. So, I mean, again, that's part of that learning curve, because this whole guy's career has been with his hand on the ground, watching the ball, waiting for the snap, and only worrying about the guy right in front of him. Now he's standing up, seeing the entire offensive formation and having to listen to a cadence and a snap count to know when to jump. So his first step, which was never elite in the first place, is probably even going to be less elite now, because I mean now he's got to think about snap counts and getting the right, you know, and look for a few offsides penalties this year.
Well, we got enough of those from Antonio Smith.
Exactly.
But, I mean, I think you're right with the lack of the quick first step. And plus, you got to figure in, I mean, he's 6'7". Now, you can minimize some of that leverage when your hand's on the ground, because, I mean, the low man wins, as they say in the NFL. But when you're standing up, I mean, how do you combat that?
I don't know how you do it. And Ron Jaworski thinks he's 6'9", in the broadcast. So apparently Wade Phillips
That's
has
like
learned.
Charles Barkley's 6'6". Yeah. Or...
Apparently Wade Phillips has learned how to coach height. Because Mario is now 6'9". Where he entered camp at 6'7", which is phenomenal.
Power forward for the Rockets?
I think maybe Wade needs to talk to Chuck Hayes.
All right, well, let's move off of Mario. Hopefully he'll turn it around here in this the Saints game coming up on Saturday. Let me get your thoughts on a couple other players that had good games. First, someone that I am a big fan of, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Oh, yeah, Obi-Wan Benaiah.
Yeah, Obi-Wan Benaiah.
He is our only hope.
This is the running back you're looking for. Your thoughts, can he be the third string running back?
Yeah, I think he can be third string. I mean, I'm
obviously behind Foster and Ward.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to dampen down the expectations a little bit. A lot of the big runs he got on Monday night were on these screens where half the Jets defense was already in the backfield, and he would catch these little lob passes from Matt Leinart and break off 25-yard runs. So, I mean, you know, I'm going to tamper down the expectations a little bit on him, but I mean, I think he's perfectly serviceable as a third down back, especially if you get in a situation where, and Derek Ward and Arian Foster are pretty big dudes, but this team historically has had problems scoring on the goal line, getting short yardage situations, stuff like that. Chris Obanaya is a beast.
Yeah, he's a big guy. Know, he used to be a fullback at Texas.
Exactly. He was a fullback at Texas. So, I mean, I like the idea of having another option in goal line and short yardage there as well.
Yeah, I hope he makes the roster. I mean, you would think Slayton obviously didn't show anything the last couple of years. And if, you know, Ben Tate reportedly played at practice Thursday, but we'll see if he can stay on the field. Moving on, another young guy. A guy that caught a touchdown pass late, Lestar Jean, a big kid. I think
Lestar.
He's 6'4", or as Jaws would say, 6'7". And, I mean, could this guy, and Kubiak seems to already be talking about it, but could this guy sneak in and maybe take Dickerson's spot and see some time as a fourth receiver?
I think it's entirely possible, because he showed himself to be a reliable deep ball receiver in that game.
He'd certainly
Monday
be
night.
Good in the red zone.
Exactly. He was good in the red zone, and he did well against double coverage.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing that impressed me. I mean, look at, I believe it was the 27-yarder that he caught was right between two Jet defenders. He did well against double teams, which I think that's a trait you need to have on your team. You know, not that you're going to be seeing many with Andre Johnson.
No, hopefully
out there.
Andre will draw those. Yeah,
yeah, I don't think they're going to be double teaming Lestar.
If they want to, go ahead.
I know. I highly encourage you to do so. I mean, Lestar Jean is obviously the guy you want to double team. No, but I think that if he can beat double teams, probably can do pretty well against nickelbacks too.
Yeah,
and I think he could be, you know, emerge as a guy who's a pain in the neck. And that's what this team needs. This team doesn't need a bona fide receiver who would be a starter on another team. They just need a guy who's going to be a pain in the neck, somebody you have to game plan for.
Well, I think the hope would be is if he's the fourth receiver, you go four wide, most likely at 6'4", even if he's going up against the number one corner, he's going to be going up against someone he's physically more dominant than.
Yes.
And if he can just run the correct routes and, you know, hang on to the ball, then I think he has a chance to make a few plays.
Absolutely.
All right, another guy that made a few plays on Monday night, Brooks Reed blew up Joe McKnight.
Yes.
that was quite
Joe McKnight
a
is Brooks Reed's son.
And
yes.
Then I think it was the very next play, made a very nice deflection. Your thoughts on Brooks Reed?
I mean, look, this was one of the guys that we had a lot of concerns about in the beginning because he was drafted very highly. And of all the people who are really catching on camp, Brian Braman, people like that, it looked like Brooks Reed was the slowest on the learning curve, that he just wasn't putting it all together right away. Well, that was my analysis about 3 days before, preseason game. And whatever happened in those 3 days, he fixed it because that guy looked like an absolute beast out there. And, yeah, he's incredibly disruptive, which is what you want to see. Now, granted, a lot of his disruptions were against some of the second-team players, I believe, that were out there at the time. I mean, he wasn't out there against the first-teamers like Connor Barwin was. You know, so, I mean, you do have to factor that into it. But you saw enough to make you believe that by mid-season, this guy should be an effective guy that you could possibly start if you needed to.
Right.
And, I mean, the Clay Matthews comparisons are going to be there for
it's
that.
It's not valid. Yeah, I think it's just because of the hair.
For both the play and the hair. But probably more valid for the hair than the play.
Right.
At this point. But, I mean, I'm thrilled with what I saw Monday night. And hopefully he'll get his hands on Drew Brees this weekend.
I hope so. If he could be two-thirds of what Clay Matthews is, I'd be happy with that. We certainly will find out more this Saturday against the Saints. Now, moving on to a different sport. A team with not as bright of a future, I would say, the Houston Astros. I have to ask you a question. Do you know who Colin DeLome is?
Let me guess.
I'll give you some time.
He is going to be our future third baseman.
I hope not. Colin DeLome was the first pick signed 4 years ago when the Astros had that disaster when they didn't sign any picks until the fifth round. He was the first guy signed. The reason I bring that up is, obviously, a couple of days ago, they signed George Springer right before the deadline.
Yep.
Also got Jack Armstrong, their third pick. I believe his name's Jack Armstrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, your overall thoughts. When do you think we could expect to see George Springer at Minute Maid Park?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you got to factor in two things. Not only his ascent through the minors and how well he does in the minors, but the needs of the team.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the players that George Springer had always been talked about as Carlos Lee's eventual replacement in left field. Well, you know, now we have JD Martinez who's swinging the bat pretty well and doing well out there in the field himself. So, you know, you start looking at center field as maybe where he ends up. And I mean, honestly, if Jordan Schaefer, who we got in the Michael Bourne trade from the Braves, if he doesn't show, you know, well, then, I mean, I think that's a move you could make. I mean, you know, I think maybe, I don't want to say next year.
No,
next year is too early.
He is a college player. But he's
a college player. He's not going to go to Lancaster. He's not going to go to A-ball. He's going to go
hopefully not. The Astros have, unfortunately, historically slow-tracked players. But
I think in this case, the players will be fast-tracked. He'll go to Double-A. I think he plays next year in Double-A and Triple-A. I think by 2013. There's a chance that he could be in that starting lineup.
Unless he struggles, should be 2014, though.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you really...
And I think he could play some center field, but you're right. His long-term future is probably as a corner outfielder. Another topic that's not specifically related to Houston, but I think reaches all across the country and into the city as well, the Miami situation. Certainly, I mean, SMU We're all talking about the death penalty with Miami, and SMU obviously got it in the late 80s. I mean, your thoughts. I mean, one, should Miami get the death penalty? And let's start there. Do you think they should get the death penalty?
I've always been of the opinion that nobody's ever going to get the death penalty again. I don't think it'll happen, but I will say this. If you can't give it to Miami, you can't give it to anybody. I mean, that is the worst situation I've ever heard of. I mean, we're talking an abortion.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody died.
72 players.
You know what I mean? Somebody died in this whole thing. I mean, when you look at just the enormity of it, the severity and the depth of the entire thing, it's overwhelming to comprehend. If you can't give Miami the death penalty, then nobody ever gets the death penalty. I've been of the opinion that nobody will ever get it again. You compare it to what happened at USC. Now, think about USC here for a second. One player, one agent, $300,000, 4-year probation, 2-year bowl ban, 30 scallies.
Okay. If they get that.
Hold on. But no, hold on. We're talking about 72 players, yeah. coaches, 8 years, millions of dollars. You've got to give them at least double what USC
got. And that's not even what they deserve, really.
No, I mean, if you're not going to give death penalty, we're talking about maybe 4 or 5 years of bowl restrictions, scholarly bans.
Could you say a 4-year postseason ban and 50 scholarships is the starting point?
I honestly, I believe that's where you're starting.
Yeah, that's where you're starting.
I think
ridiculous.
I think Al Golden, poor guy. He's got to be the sickest man in America.
Yeah.
Al Golden, is the perfect guy to do this though.
From Temple.
He took a team in Temple, basketball school in Philadelphia, where college football is the last thing on anybody's mind, and built a winner out of nobody's from scratch.
Yeah.
He is the perfect guy to be, not just character-wise and stuff like that, but as a coach, as a recruiter, he's the perfect guy to do this.
I certainly hope so. Now, big picture, I mean, we talked about the death penalty. Obviously, teams and schools don't really fear it to the extent that I think they should. I mean, they gave it to SMU, and has cheating slowed down at all?
No. And also another difference, SMU is a recruiting violation.
This was not recruiting.
These were players you already had.
Part of it was recruiting, but it went beyond that.
Yeah, it went way beyond. Most of these guys who were already on campus.
So if the threat of the death penalty is not slowing down the cheating of football, I think, at least in my opinion, you've got to look at addressing the system in a different way. I agree a lot with what Jay Billis has said. I don't know if you've read anything he said about the situation. But you got to consider, I think, something close to the Olympic model, where guys can benefit off their likeness in things like jerseys. Because we all know the reason why we see 12s and 10s at Texas games is not pure luck.
No.
There's a reason for that. their likeness is used in video games that sell millions of dollars. Don't you have to at least let them get a piece of that?
Oh, no, I totally agree with that. The problem is this, though. How many players are we honestly talking about whose likeness is
a minority?
Whose likeness is used
now? The video game, everyone's used.
The video games, okay, you can get a percentage of that. I don't know how much money that turns out to be. Maybe it turns out to be a lot of money. But as far as jerseys, as far as players who are used to promote the programs and used to sell tickets and used to do things like that, appear on television, whatever it is. You're really talking about a very select minority. I don't think that addresses the entire problem. I mean, you look at Miami, we had punters on the take. Robert Marv was on the take. I mean, we're talking about scrubs here.
Who was Eric Winston's money?
Exactly. Eric Winston and Chris Myers did not apparently get in on this. But I mean,
no love.
The point being, that, I mean, you're talking about just, you know, run-of-the-mill players who got this. I mean, I'm all for the players benefiting from their likenesses, but I don't think that that's going to solve the issue. I think what has to happen here, and this is unpopular, I know, but you have to allow the major D1 schools that are revenue-producing programs with shots to win their conferences and major BCS bowl games and national championship games, you have to allow them to play by a different set of rules than the Northwesterns and the boondoggle states and
well, those
people
kids,
like
I think
that.
You bring up an interesting point. The kids at Rice are at school for a different reason than the kids at Texas.
Exactly right. I mean,
that's just the reality.
Texas is a money-making entity that is a Big 12 champion contender, national champion contender every year. They're not there for school.
Hopefully.
It's a facade. Yeah, with rare exceptions. But I mean, you know, it's a facade that they're there as student athletes. At Rice, they are legitimate student athletes. So treat them differently. Treat the revenue generating programs out there differently than you treat, you know, the programs where
the true student athlete.
Make a distinction between, and I think that's a good way to phrase it. Make a distinction between true student athletes.
And really, it's a minor league system.
Exactly. And guys who are there because they're trying to make it in the NFL one day.
Well, I do agree with that. The Olympic step would only be, or the Olympic program would only be a step in a small step in the right direction, but you've got to, I think, address the bigger issue than just penalizing guys after the fact. I think you're right. Dylan, thank you for joining us.
Anytime, my friend.